Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation here on the Sam Nation Radio Network. Greetings, friends, listeners, haters, conversationalists. We are back in the saddle. Dr. Audio, producer Robbie, and I, your host. Now, sorry for this long pause, this long absence away from our studios here deep behind the orange curtain. I will explain more about that absence a little later in the show. But I do, at this point, I got to get to some of the stuff that I have missed. I have a t-shirt on, so I can't roll up my sleeves, actually. But I'm effectively rolling up my sleeves. I am absolutely apoplectic over this characterization of Trump's tweets as being racist. I just don't get it. I mean, well, let me explain. I'll start this with the personal story. And see, this will end up, this will all be taken out of context. And if I tell my personal story, it will be chopped up, clipped up, and people will use it to show that I'm a racist. But anyway, for the record, I too, once upon a time, told someone to go home. And I'll never forget it. Do you want to hear the story? Robbie, have you heard the story? Well, I was a junior. I'll just tell you what high school. It was University High in Irvine, California. Now, I was honors chemistry. It was literally the worst class, most difficult class of my high school career. Absolute tough class. But I sat in the front row, and I had this gal I have a vivid memory of this. This gal sat next to me, and she was a fellow student. She must have been a junior as well. And I didn't know her very well, but she and her parents had come from China. Not from Taiwan, but from communist China. Now, you guys all know how I feel about communism. Not necessarily my cup of tea. And this gal, somehow we were talking about the U.S., and I probably was talking about how much, you know, how great this country is relative to other places. And, you know, I was a lot like I am now. I was just younger and smaller, thinner. There, I'll say it that way. So I'm talking with her, and all she wanted to do, folks, is tell me how great China was. China's this, China's that. We take care of people. I said, oh, you know, what about prison labor camps? What about freedom of speech? Oh, no. And, you know, and started telling me freedom of speech is bad. You know, it causes, disorganization in society and, you know, too much friction and problems. And she just wouldn't let it go. And finally, I looked at her. I said, you know what? If you like China so much, why don't you go back? Now, not one bone of my body back then nor now is racist, nor intends a statement like that to be a racial insult. It has everything to do with my experience as the son of grateful immigrants. I never, growing up, ever, ever heard my parents wistfully thinking about how great it was growing up under Joseph Stalin. Never. I don't ever remember my parents saying, boy, it was just a swell thing that we couldn't say what was on our mind, and that we were so afraid about speaking our minds that we feared getting arrested by the secret police. And oh boy, Sam, wasn't it great? And this is all tongue in cheek, by the way, because of course they didn't say any of this. Oh boy, Sam, it was so great when they took everything we owned and confiscated it and sent family members to the uranium mines. Boy, that was great. No. My parents really sacrificed a lot to come to this country legally, did so, and were extremely grateful to be here. And I'm telling you, just with no shadow of a doubt in my mind, that we didn't come here and we didn't say anything ever that was nasty about the United States. Now, when my parents came to the U.S., and this is really important, do you know who was president? Jimmy Carter. That's right. And when Carter was president, my parents couldn't stand Carter. But there was something different about the way that they treated this situation than the way the left treats the current political climate. For my parents, they didn't like Carter, but they loved America. It's an easy compromise. And today, you don't need to love Trump. We get it. You think he's the worst human being. He disrespects women. He's a racist. I got it. Okay, I got it. And even if I were to accept all of these premises that the crazy left puts out there about Trump, why are they taking it a step further and disrespecting America as a result? I kept meaning to talk about the story. And of course, I usually have ideas about things before they happen. And then the story got big. But the example I will give you that doesn't involve the squad, doesn't involve Ilhan Omar and AOC, is Megan Rapinoe, the U.S. soccer, women's soccer team captain. Now, you know, our ladies won some matches and then ended up winning the big match. Big deal. But, no, I'm meaning that. Actually, seriously, it's a big deal. It's awesome. But months ago, Rapinoe, before the enormous ascent, before the Women's World Cup was well underway, was in the news for her refusal to recite the Pledge of Allegiance, the anthem, and do any, you know, stand for the anthem, anything. And it was because her statement at the time was, look, I can't support this country as long as Trump is president. It's absurd. It's not who we are. We have a political system that for the most part is a two-party system. Sometimes your guy is in office, sometimes my guy's in the office. But it doesn't matter. We still love America. The flag may mean something different to you than it does to me. That's okay. But this country is our country. And it's interesting because the same criticisms that are being leveled at Trump, how dare you say something like, why don't you go back to where you came from if you hate this place so much? I'm paraphrasing his tweet. How dare he say that? This is our country. And suddenly, after Trump tweeted this, suddenly the Democrats were talking about this country being our country. As in the place that we all love. When ever since basically before the election, and certainly after, all that we have heard is absolute histrionics from the left about how this country has gone to hell in a handbasket. I don't even recognize. How many times have you heard this? I don't even recognize this country anymore. If you don't, what does that even mean? This is a democracy. We all have a right to vote. Your guy, Obama, was in office for 8 years. I never once said, man, this country is just awful. This sucks. My whole approach to it was, oh my goodness, I've got to save this country from Obama. I love this country. Thus, I have to speak up and let my opinions be known about the president that I don't like. Because I don't like his policies. I don't think his policies are good for our country. Now, I'll tell you, that's the high level look at all of this. There is, Well, okay, I understand the criticism, right, that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was born here, and so you can tell somebody. It's like telling me to go back to the Czech Republic. I was born here. You know, I'm an American. What can I tell you? But Ilhan Omar, this lady, she literally comes from one of the worst countries on the planet. I'm just saying that. I don't think you'd want to live in Somalia. Czech Republic's pretty nice, actually, if you've been to Prague. Mogadishu is not Prague. So, yeah. So nobody wants to live in Somalia that they can help it. She comes here. This country is her home. Invites her in. She has a career. She becomes a congressperson. I'm using the term that would probably be adopted by, what was it, Berkeley? Was it Berkeley, California with their gender pronouns? We'll talk about that later. She becomes a congressperson. Now what is she? She is an elected representative of the U.S. government, both literally, as in that's the title of her position, and she's also a representative of the government. And from that bully pulpit, all she does is tell us how awful America is. And I'm going to tell you, as the son of immigrants, as somebody that loves immigrants, as somebody who I have a longer connection to Europe, to someplace else that isn't here. But as somebody that loves this country, I'm offended by this. And not in some pathetic, you know, protest, I'm a victim offended kind of way. No, it's offensive. And literally, I think that if you have come to this country and come here and criticize this country, then I'm at a loss of understanding why you're here. So Trump and all of this it's a manufactured controversy. Now, there is, in my opinion, a very clever thing that Trump is doing here. Because you know that when he drops these things, when he says, you know, if you don't like it here, if you came from an asshole country, you don't like it here, go back. And, you know, he knows the media is going to jump all over it. He knows the media is going to have a cow. He knows there's going to be a lot of tutting about it. But he also knows that in so doing, he takes these kooky fringe members of the Democratic Party and elevates them, puts them in the spotlight. And he did it when? He did it at the exact time that Nancy Pelosi was starting to be successful at booting them out of relevance in the Democratic Party. Nancy Pelosi, do you remember all of this? I know. This is where my dereliction of duty comes in. I wasn't here last week or the week before to explain to you all of this. But if you'll recall the time frame here, Nancy Pelosi was just in the middle of explaining how these four ladies, Cortez, Omar, Presley, and Tlaib, were just, you know, fringe members, and they get a lot of likes on Instagram or whatever, but they're not relevant to the Democratic Party. Trump lays into it, and everybody, what's the conventional thinking? Oh my gosh, Trump, what did you do? They were on their way out, and you just lit the whole forest back on fire. And all these smart people on television that I was watching when I was on vacation and at the office and at night, I was looking at this, all these just talking heads that are paid gazillions of dollars collectively to tell you and I what's up, are all hand-wringing. And they've got it all wrong. Trump was actually worried that these ladies were going to get sidelined and were going to become less relevant. Now, if you think that I'm just on one, I'll tell you, I think Dave Axelrod actually agrees with me. You remember he was Obama's chief strategist. And here is Axelrod talking to Anderson Cooper on CNN. explaining how Trump's tweets, maybe, just maybe, are strategic.
He wants to elevate these four young members of Congress to make them the emblem of the Democratic Party. And he wants to be so outrageous about it that he forces all Democrats to embrace them, to support the argument that they are the iconic figures in the party. But I just have to take a step back as a strategist and say I recognize what he's doing. And a lot of what he does is intuitive.
Totally.
It's not mapped out, but it's worked for him.
Yes, bingo. The squad, AOC, Omar, Presley, Tlaib, all on the outs with Nancy Pelosi. The fact that Nancy put out that strongly worded put down of AOC meant that she in that moment felt she had enough political capital to do so. Say what you want about Pelosi, she is a seasoned political operative. And Trump, whether he can articulate it or not, sensed that he needed to step in and poke the bear. And when he did it, the knee-jerk reaction, just as Axelrod says, the knee-jerk reaction of the left was to rally to these ladies' defense, to re-embrace them and support them. And next thing you know, it's guilt by association. You've got Omar out there with her ridiculous statements about the awful things the military did in Mogadishu and talking about Jews and all this stuff. She's a wackadoodle and a bigot. And Trump forced the left, the Democratic Party establishment, and the media to get back in her corner. And it is brilliant. Trust me. Sam Rogowski here on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
Sam Rogowski here. I permit me for a minute to explain my longer than usual absence from the show. On 4th of July weekend, we were away in Hawaii. That was a planned absence. And on Friday morning, as I was preparing to do the program, putting together some show prep, I had to rush to the hospital and subsequently learned of the passing of a very dear friend of ours. And so my whole Friday last week and the week that has ensued since has been just really very sad. I have to tell you about my friend. Really a remarkable man. I've talked about Ron on the program before in the abstract. I've referenced him, but Ron was just a fantastic guy. He was a Marine. He was a law enforcement officer back in the East Coast, and he then came to California and started an enormously successful business. And at 80 years old, he was the CEO of his business, and he went to work every day. This guy was the spirit of health. I know 80 sounds to some of you maybe like an advanced age, but I'm telling you, Ron wore it well, and those of us who knew him believed that there were many, many good years left. And I think I have a couple of observations. One, it's never too late to have a good time in life. Life is precious. And I think the defining things that make life good, at least for me, are the relationships that I have with people. The relationships I have with my family, with my wife, with my kids, with my parents. The relationships I have with close friends that are almost like family. couple of them here in the studio. These poor guys are stuck with me. I mean, it is, this is what it is. You can do something by yourself and it's great. You do it with someone you love and it's amazing. And we met Ron and Nancy a couple years of two years ago. Not a long time. And yet almost 3 years ago. In a relatively short period of time, in a blip, right? What's 3 years? We became so close and really it was a wonderful thing. I've never had neighbors that just become a part of the family the way that they have. And we are all, Sherry and I and the kids, are just left with an enormous hole in our hearts, missing someone that we loved, and we will miss you, Ron. And we love you. And Nancy, I just want to tell you, I know you're a listener of the program, and I want to tell you that we just absolutely adore you and love you and are grateful that that you're part of our lives. All right. Let's go to break. I'll come back and we'll talk some more about politics. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam, Sam Rogowski. You'll find him very interesting. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
Sam Nation here behind the Sam Nation microphone, telling it how it is. Speaking of which, Ilhan Omar. Go back to Somalia, Ilhan Omar. Or so somehow goes a racist saying, per the media. Now, I in the first segment mentioned that I thought this is just a load of crap. I know there's Republicans even. There are Republicans or conservatives, people I know, who are saying that Trump went overboard. Here are just some of Ilhan Omar's past greatest hits. Do you remember when she's talking about CARE, the Council on Islamic American Relations, and they look, these people raise money for some suspicious folks out there. They gave money to Hamas. I mean, really, really legitimately frightening group of people. And but ostensibly, the front of the organization is to convince all of us that Islam is all good and peachy and everything's fine and there's no terrorism involved. So CARE, this is her quote, CARE was founded after 9/11 because they recognized that some people did something and that all of us were starting to lose access to our civil liberties. Now, the civil liberties argument, that I can get behind. We all lost some civil liberties after 9/11. And we can have a debate on that, and I may even perhaps agree with her. But some people did something. Some people did some. I mean, I think we were attacked. I think thousands of people died. I don't think you can characterize it as something, and it's... Well, speaking of Al-Qaeda, right, so she said that people thought that the word Al-Qaeda was unnecessarily scary, that people say it as if it's some kind of a big deal. Well, Miss Omar, the word Al-Qaeda, for those people who survived 9/11 and those people who lost people in 9/11, is kind of a scary big deal. So that was a couple of things that she said. What else did she say? The Battle of Mogadishu. There was an anniversary. Some people on Twitter commemorated the anniversary. And of course, they were paying tribute to the American soldiers that had died serving our country and actually intended, I mean, the purpose of the mission was to go in and maintain order so that more people in Somalia wouldn't die. And her response, her tweeted response to that was, in his responding to the Twitter user that commemorated the deaths of the American soldiers, she wrote, quote, in his selective memory, he forgets to also mention the thousands of Somalis killed by the American forces that day, exclamation point, hashtag not today, Satan, close quote. And I think, oh my gosh, I'm at a loss. I'm at a total loss. This, can you imagine, by the way, can you imagine if the French, if there was a French immigrant to this country somewhere, let's say in the 1950s, and they had survived World War II, Normandy invasion, right, of their country, D-Day, Allied bombing. And they, you know, on D-Day, when we're having a commemorative event here in the U.S. at a local cemetery, let's say, and this person were to comment, well, wait, we're not commemorating all of the French people Americans killed in their quest to free our country and get rid of Adolf Hitler. I mean, it's astounding at how stupid some of this stuff is. And it also is just, these are things that normal, happy, adjusted, grateful immigrants do not say when they come here. Now, yes, this is not a, now, by the way, it's not a freedom of speech argument. Of course, she can say all of this. The fact that she's a congresswoman doesn't matter. She can say it, whatever. But it is, for me, a fundamental question of gratitude. And I don't think she has any of it. No. Well, yes. And then we're going to get into the chant, because this is another thing that is totally mischaracterized and has been, and every newspaper from the Washington Post, New York Times on down has run with this. The question of Trump at the rally the other day, the chant, and how Trump handled it. I'll tell you exactly what occurred. Sam Rejofsky, Sam Nation, here on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
Sam Rejofsky, Sam Nation. All right. When Trump was at the rally in Greenville, North Carolina, he said, well, he was talking about Ilhan Omar, and the crowd started chanting, send her back, send her back. And this is after the initial tweet controversy arose earlier in the week. And, well, I'll tell you, so the next day, on Thursday, Trump is asked whether he agrees or agreed with the chant that was being yelled in the hall where his rally was being held. He was asked, President, Mr. President, if I may, when your supporters last week were chanting, send her back, why didn't you stop them? Why didn't you ask them to stop saying that?
I think I did. I started speaking very quickly. It really was a loud, I disagree with it, by the way, but it was quite a chant. I felt a little bit badly about it, but I will say this, I did, and I started speaking very quickly, but it started up rather fast, as you probably noticed.
So you'll tell your supporters never to
say
that again?
I would say that. I was not happy with it. I disagree with it. But again, I didn't say that they did, but I disagree.
Okay, now I watched it. I saw it. I'm going to tell you what, I don't think he liked it in the moment. He pursed his lips. He didn't encourage it. He stopped talking. So, yeah, he didn't in the moment say, no, don't. But he also was not stoked about it. I can tell you that much. Now, the way this is being characterized is that he's just flat out lying. I don't think that's the case at all. I watched it, and you can go back and see it, and you tell me what you think. By the way, from the rally, I thought that the most it's interesting because you watch these things and then it's fascinating. The part of it that catches fire is usually the part that I don't think is going to catch fire, and vice versa. And the part I thought was just so funny, but also such a risky maneuver, was when he was talking about the least well-known squad member, Ayanna Pressley, congresswoman from Massachusetts. And he pauses and he smiles in a classic kind of Trump way. He smirks and he says, "Pressley, I wonder if she's related to Elvis Pressley. I really don't know." Now, the reason it's funny is because Ms. Pressley is African-American. And she and Elvis really do not look at all alike. But Trump was making a joke about, how colorblind he is with people. That's how I took it, right? He was making a joke about not noticing these type of things. And it was so funny in the moment. It was hilarious. And the crowd went wild and it was raucous. And again, I haven't heard a boo really about it anywhere on the major channels. So it's an interesting thing, the kind of thing that catches on fire and the stuff that doesn't. But I'm telling you, this whole thing here, this center back, the bumper stickers, I remember seeing cars when I was a kid with the bumper sticker, love it or leave it, America, love it or leave it. If you don't like it here, go. And this is, by the way, why all these celebrities, when Trump gets elected or George W. Bush gets elected, and all I hear from Hollywood is, "I'm out of here, I'm moving to Canada." Well, don't let the door hit you on the way out. And in that sense, telling even a red-blooded American who is full of, nasty, nasty hate for America because, Trump's in the White House, getting them, telling them rhetorically, "Hey, if you don't like it, get out." I don't know. There's absolutely nothing racist about this. It's a pure and simple matter of gratitude and patriotism. And patriotism isn't nationalism. That's a difference. You love this country, and you can disagree with people. You can disagree with the guy in charge. You can disagree with you can hate on the politics all you want, but love America. Be grateful for what we have here, because I tell you, there's plenty of places in the world where things are a lot worse. All right, Sam Rojofsky, Sam Nation, here on the Sam Nation Radio Network. Back right after this.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, he.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, on the show tonight is Sam Rojofsky. Now, what Sam is the leading word in correct thinking, as opposed to Ed, which is drunk thinking. And that's usually where the left ends up, on the wrong side of right.
Sam Rojofsky, Sam Nation, here on the Sam Nation Radio Network. When I was in Hawaii on my way to the wedding, I went there for a wedding. Beautiful event. A couple of our friends tied the knot. I was in the Uber on my way to the venue, and I was bored, and I looked at my phone, and I saw a thing pop up that Jeffrey Epstein had been arrested in New York. I have to tell you, I was so happy to hear it, because, of course, this guy, I'm a father. I've got two girls. This guy, the less of Jeffrey Epstein that there is out there in the world, the better. But let me tell you a couple of observations about this whole thing. First of all, the relentless effort in the media to say Jeffrey Epstein had powerful friends like Bill Clinton and Donald Trump is such a load of horse crap, I don't even know where to begin with it. Well, because it's apples to oranges. Bill Clinton was still his friend. Bill Clinton wrote on that airplane, I've seen the logs. They have these logs, and those tend to be pretty accurate, because if they put a name on it, that name really was on the airplane. And there are all sorts of penalties for filling out those logs improperly. So that's on the captain, whoever the PIC is, who's the pilot in command. The logs are accurate. So Bill Clinton wrote on that airplane over and over again, and he's saying, oh, it was to some charity junkets. We'll see about that. Trump, you want to know the straight scoop on Trump? Trump and Epstein were party friends. They hung out. They did stuff together. Trump didn't use drugs and didn't drink, so him and Epstein really didn't have that much to talk about. Plus, I'm going to tell you this. Trump likes women, but he likes them developed. Okay, I'm just going to put it that way. Trump is not one into the little 15-year-olds. Not his thing. What happened, and it's been documented through a series of lawsuits against Epstein, is that Trump basically blacklisted Epstein from Mar-a-Lago after Epstein allegedly assaulted an employee there. Trump did the right thing. And this is years ago. The lawsuit that mentions the incident was back in 2011. The incident happened even earlier than that. This is before Donald Trump was the most hated president in the history of the world. It was before the left hated him. It was before the left wanted to paint him as a womanizing pussy grabber. So I'm telling you, that's what happened. It's well documented. Now the other part of this story, of course, is that now that the Southern District of New York, do you know about this? The Southern District of New York is the most feared federal prosecution district in the United States. I think, in my opinion, I'm telling you as a lawyer, whoever the U.S. attorney is in the Southern District of New York, which covers Manhattan, is the attorney that is the person that is most, how would I say this? The person who has the largest political appetite. If you're the U.S. attorney in Kansas, big effing deal. I mean, that's a sleep position. I don't know what you're doing there. You're probably chasing savings and loan scandals and I don't know. You get an occasional bank robbery. But the Southern District of New York, that's where all the big companies are, big international scandals, big thing. And that to get that position, you've got to be politically connected. And so not just the main U.S. attorney, but the whole office is filled with politically conscious people. And for these politically conscious people, taking down big players is good. It's a nice thing. That's what they want. So for them, Epstein is a big scalp. I hope that their case is solid. And for everybody that thinks that their case is solid because Epstein really is a dirty bird, I say just be careful. Because the devil is in the details with these type of prosecutions. The deal that Epstein struck down in Florida that was authored by Alex Acosta, the now former Secretary of Labor, back when he was the U.S. attorney in Miami, that deal has validity, okay? It's a U.S. attorney. And it's not, I've heard people say it was only valid down in Florida. No. It now depends on where, if the crimes that were in that deal, those crimes are going to be exempt. That's what his lawyers are going to argue all day long, that that nothing there is new, that it's all stuff that was covered by by the previous deal. Where it runs into trouble is hubris. And I will explain what I mean by this. So first, Epstein's arrested. Then they, right as they arrest him, they break open, they have a warrant, I hope, but they break open into his mansion in New York City, this beautiful $7 million mansion on the Upper East Side. And within about 24 hours, there is smoke coming out of the house. The fire department gets called, but there isn't a fire. Do you know where the smoke was coming from? Yeah, the FBI was drilling into Epstein's safe. So they crack his safe open. It takes them a bunch of time to do it because apparently this thing was pretty solid. And inside, remember I said it was hubris. Inside, they find disks and disks and disks containing many, many files of what? Child porn. This guy is so stupid. So you're you are a convicted pedophile. B, you're out on parole. C, you need to check in and register, which he didn't. D, you've got the Miami Herald winning prizes in their documentary, basically expose on you and the sweetheart deal you got. You see that there's all this new activity and interest in your case. The Me Too movement is coming along, and you have child pornography in your safe. This guy is, I actually think they're going to get him on those charges. If you want my honest opinion, that's going to be the slam dunk. They don't have to use anybody's testimony. They don't have to rely on witnesses that can be, perhaps influenced. They're going to take what they found in the safe and they're going to put him away for the rest of his life. So that's the part of the case, and nobody's really saying this, but that's the part of the case that I think is the strongest. It's just the easiest, most straightforward part of the case. It's not covered by the non-prosecution agreement, and it doesn't rely on these witnesses. And some of these witnesses, I have to tell you, I feel very sympathetic to these girls. They've been through hell. I'm not sure that they're all 100% truthful. And there's been a lot of back and forth on this. You know, there are other people that are entangled in this web and they're fighting hard and they have evidence to prove that some of the things that they are testifying to aren't accurate. Also, we're talking about people that were kids, right? These were 14, 15-year-olds. Maybe they don't remember everything accurately. And good lawyers can really wiggle witnesses like that and make for a strong case of reasonable doubt. But that doesn't work for pictures in the safe on disks. I don't think so. So that is where this is headed. He is in jail, no bail. Judge Berman in this case he's a nasty judge. He's gonna keep this guy. I don't think Epstein's getting out. So we've got that happening. One thing that I missed here, and we didn't do the show for 2 weeks. Do you remember this UK ambassador to the US, Sir Kim Derrick? Now Kim is a man. Don't be fooled by the name. But Sir Derrick is the guy who wrote a number of cables that ended up being leaked. And in these cables, he's transmitting these to London, to the State Department in London, telling them of his impressions of the Trump presidency. And in it, he called Trump all sorts of terrible things. Inept was just probably one of the nicer things that he said. And my comment on the story at the time was, I loved how the media just ran with it as, well, we have this source that is above reproach, that has no bias. He's not a political actor. He's an ambassador, and he can see how inept Trump is. Why can't Trump supporters finally open their eyes and realize what a buffoon the Trumpster is? And then I saw an article that didn't get linked up by anybody to anything, but it was an article talking about how this Ambassador Derek fella was a huge fan of Christopher Steele and thought that the Christopher Steele documentary, this is a this is the Golden Showers dossier, was a good bit of work. And he went on the record with that. And then I thought, I just put my hands up and I said, well, this is everything I need to know. Because if this guy thinks that this crackpot dude wrote a report on how Trump, who is the most notorious germ freak on the planet, paid prostitutes to pee on a bed in a hotel room in Moscow that he was staying in. I mean, if he thought that report was great, well, then any opinion he has about Trump for me is out the window. But that, of course, linking those things together, that would be good journalism, and we saw none of that. So anyway, look, we're going to have a little bit of a shorter show today. Everything that we have going on, I will be back here, I promise you, within the week. The next Democratic debate is on the 31st of Wednesday. The race is interesting, and next program, I promise you, I will get into this. Thank you for being patient with me today. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, on the Sam Nation Radio Network. Before.